Hello, friends. It's Dr. Curtis here with another edition of the WFO Life podcast. In this episode, we had something really special here. Lieutenant Colonel Story and I interviewed friend and researcher Jerome Dixon. Jerome Dixon is a Naval Academy graduate. He has a master's in information technology. He also has a master's degree in decision-making analytics. He's also a PhD student currently working in genomic research and as it applies specifically to individual patient therapy. And we get into this and we go into the weeds with this a great deal. And it's really, really fascinating what research is out there and how ultimately it's going to impact individuals and how they receive healthcare. We talked about data related to COVID-19. Some interesting insights from basically a seasoned statistician. We talked about how data points can be flawed and how that can affect policy and how many of the current things we're seeing in regarding the COVID-19 research are based on incomplete information. And we cover how that matters so much. We also talk about artificial intelligence, and we go off on various tangents in that field. And also where and how technology and data will be impacting how we receive and deliver healthcare in the world. So this was a lot of fun interviewing Jerome Dixon, and I think there was a lot of great pearls throughout. So I hope you'll enjoy this conversation, and feel free to leave comments and messages. And now, the bumper music. Welcome to the WFO Life Podcast. Buckle up for interviews, insights, and practical discussions, and the occasional intellectual oddity, all designed to help you master self, master craft, and accomplish any life mission.
All right. Good evening, everybody. So we're going to have another interview tonight, which I think is very timely, given what's going on in the world and the background of our guest, Jerome Dixon. So I've worked with Jerome in the past, and he's a friend of mine. But I'm going to hit a few highlights of what I know about Jerome, and then open the floor up to him to talk about his current work. But Jerome retired from the United States Navy after 20 years. He attended the United States Naval Academy and was a football player there at Navy. And some of the career highlights besides operational tours were a lot of educational highlights that I know we're going to end up discussing tonight. But he's got a master's degree from the Naval Postgraduate School in Information Technology. He's also got a master's of Decision Analytics from Virginia Commonwealth University with a healthcare emphasis. And currently he's a doctoral candidate at VCU. And I think his current work in health and analytics and where that comes together, I think is a something that we're all living right now with the current COVID-19 outbreak. So with that, Jerome, I'll let you open it up and talk a little bit about yourself and your current work.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. So currently I do a couple things. I do some consulting for the state Behavioral Health Agency, Department of Behavioral Health and Development Services. I help out with this Youth Substance Abuse Grant as a data consultant, program evaluator person, part-time. And then I also do full-time for a company called Canon Advisors, operations research, modeling, forecasting, simulation, more on the supply chain business side, but trying to do more healthcare stuff. And then for my PhD program, I'm really focused on personalized medicine and basically how to match up basically the research out there to a patient based on their genomics and specific profile. I'm working with the School of Pharmacy to help out with Parkinson's disease patients, looking at how to use genomics to kind of improve and give them more specialized care. Looking at the exercise, brain function, as well as drug markers to basically optimize that care plan. So
okay, yeah, I was gonna say it's a good segue for Dr. Curtis, because I know a lot of what he tries to do in his practice is to treat the patients as an individual and not do kind of that wham bam thank you ma'am medicine, and really get a profile. And I know he's done some work with concierge doctor services. So I know you're probably interested in kind of advancing that even further with analytics and genomics.
Yeah, absolutely. So Jerome, first off, it's a pleasure to virtually meet you, and Chris has kind of told me a little about you, and I didn't realize you were a Navy guy and football player and all that kind of stuff. And as I was going through your resume of master's degrees and decision analytics and all those things, I was thinking you have a bigger head than most people, obviously. And one of the things I was really excited about when you were just saying is about this genomic specific therapies, and how you're trying to kind of match that up and look at data and how that matches to the individual person. Because I read a long time ago, and maybe you can comment on this because it's probably one of the ones you know about. Everybody, I'm a practicing physician, so every day I have to make decisions for individual people. And what's interesting is that if you look at studies like, let's say, a drug like Plavix, and forgive me if I miss the actual percentage here, but I was told that, say a person has a stent or they have a vascular condition, so everybody's supposed to be on Plavix. That's the guideline. If they have a stent, put them on Plavix, right? Well, the funny thing about this particular drug is that I think the stat is as high as 40% of people don't respond to it at all, meaning it doesn't do anything for about 40% of the population genetically. But then at the same time, they get all of the potential side effect, if you will. And is that the same kind of field you're in, or am I missing?
That's exactly what I'm looking at. So basically, we were talking about is the phenotypes and the four classifications. Whether they are it's broken down into what type of metabolizer they are for that drug.
Right.
And there's definitely genetic markers that will tell you whether they are an ultra metabolizer, that means they can metabolize it really quickly, or whether they're a poor metabolizer and where they can't actually get that drug out of their system, and it actually leads to a higher concentrations in their plasma. So there's gene markers that will tell you what kind of metabolizer they are for certain drugs.
Right. So you end up in a situation where, like, if you knew that information going in as a prescriber, which I know I'm not at that level right now, other than I know that a couple of tests can be ordered. But if we knew going in, hey, I could make a decision about giving this guy aspirin or giving this guy Plavix or whatever, if I had some genetic, I know genetics are not perfect in a sense that, it's not always blue eyes and brown eyes. There's a lot of gray area and multifocal areas of the genetic code. But what's interesting, it would be great at the level of care to be able to say, yeah, you're like much more likely to not respond well to this drug. And,
yes.
Whether that be a blood pressure med, I know they can do it with antibiotics as well. Probably, that's like the gist of cancer therapy nowadays, isn't it?
Yeah. They're definitely seeing that depending on your genomic makeup, that there's definitely more customizable, tailored, I would say, therapies that work better for you. And also the FDA, FDA does do a lot of testing as far as what gene markers and what drugs metabolize a certain way. But obviously not all drugs, not all folks get the gene testing done.
Yeah, I could see that being difficult, like you were saying, Dr. Curtis, that, a lot of times, even if it's in the case of Plavix that you gave, even if it's effective on, 60% of the people, that's still going to be the recommendation, right? It's difficult if you're not getting, that detailed testing on every patient because it's not feasible. You may go with the 60% solution, right? I mean, I think that's where hopefully data and I'm assuming as tests become cheaper and more accessible, it's more realistic to do that for every patient.
Well, the other thing too is, if they already have their ancestry or family 23 DNA extract, you can go to the FDA CPIC website right now to see what drugs match with your gene markers.
Hmm. Wait, back up on that. Okay, so if 23andMe, which I know a lot of my patients have done, You can, you have your breakdown and you can actually cross-reference that on another site.
Yes. If you
what
go
is that
to,
site
it's
again?
Called, it's called the CPIC guidelines. It's CPICPGX.org. And they basically publish all the FDA drugs and markers.
Wow. Okay.
So that's cool. So basically, if the patient has done that, obviously, what's on the FDA site, it matches to a certain. It's not like unique to that person, but if you have that person's unique markers, you can match it up to what the FDA has. What you're
correct.
Saying, right?
Correct.
Okay. Okay. That's well, that's cool.
Who's using that information right now? I mean, like what's the most cutting edge thing you can think of that doctors or healthcare or researchers are using based on that information?
So I'm at VCU. VCU is a very, very forward thinking academic hospital. So they actually do the testing for all anyone that comes through there. They do it automatically. So
okay.
But I know I fit around with my own extracts, and I did a mini kind of lookup with the CPIC guidelines. I basically downloaded the CPIC guidelines as an Excel spreadsheet, looked at my markers, did like a little lookup, see if I could do it.
Yeah. Interesting. So I'm wondering, like, I'm integrated. I have an EMR that it's starting. You can see every year that goes on, it's becoming more and more integrated with all kinds of data sets. In fact, just today I noticed that, you know, it was integrating with hospital systems. And so everything's sort of, I guess, you know, starting to come together. What would be awesome is if these, you know, data sets could be released directly regarding a patient to a specific physician or that type of thing, so that, you know, we could make decisions based on this. Because I mean, we make this decision all the time, and I hate it whenever we give a patient a med and they come back with some serious reaction, and you're just like, I wonder if this could have been, prevented.
Yeah. I know the FDA is building an API to that, but it's not ready yet. But you could download a CSV spreadsheet file of all the guidelines, load it in.
Interesting. I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, you know what? One of the funny things, a job that where Jerome and I shared together. I won't mention the agency in case we go down a dark path, but it's, you know, we worked at a large government agency together. And I know, you know, there, and it was a joint agency. So every service in a lot of cases has its own, I guess one of the terms I heard a lot and you probably live in is like a data lake, right? You try to integrate as much as you can and have this like data lake where everything exists and you have these extracts and like, you know, Dr. Curtis was talking about the EMR and integrating different things. How close are we to getting, you know, like we tried to get in the government agency, a just 100% integrated data lake where all this stuff can reside and get pulled into? Is that feasible in the near future, or will AI help put to do that? Or
So I think the big thing with that one is they do have what's called the FHIR protocol, FHIR, and that's basically a way, if you can remember DILMS, Chris.
Yeah.
So FHIR is basically DILMS for healthcare. It basically tells you the transaction types, what fields will be in there, so everyone can have that common way of communicating back and forth. So that protocol is, I want to say, fairly new. I don't think everyone's done it, but I think a lot of your EHR folks and other folks are kind of building to that. So I think the exchange of information is there. Then it's going to be obviously, you know, the accessibility. And the thing about data is the new oil, right? The new bacon per se. Whoever has that data, that's value, right? So I see the problem is going to be, how do you share that?
Yeah, I could see that. I remember some of the frustration we had is like if you work like on a ship or in our case, like, you know, if you're at the fleet level, like, you know, that data exists, right? And then as you get higher in rank and like in that case, we were at a government agency and they're like, oh, I really wish we could see, you know, where the pain is. And you're like, well, I know that data is out there. But getting the systems to talk to each other and have, you know, the lines of data lined up correctly where it can get pulled into the system. I mean, a lot of it is just the mechanics of it, right? Like,
well,
you know, the
well,
data.
It's also the different views, right? So at the fleet level, you know, they're operating. They're worried about like, hey, you know, my status, and they're also going by the metrics that, you know, the organization may be having run to. Where at another agency, they may be doing something else. So you have a lot of contextual mix matches.
Yeah.
And I think you remember that with the, what was that one initiative with the...
the dashboards.
The one with the cradle to grave supply chain metrics. Remember that one?
Yeah.
Where people couldn't agree on what a requirement was because they worried about, you know, what stage of the process that they could actually control, kind of thing. They didn't want to be on a hook for a certain piece that they didn't own.
Yeah, I mean, and I, you know, now that we're jumping ahead to like current events right now, you know, so for example, you know, Dr. Curtis on the front lines of people getting sick, you know, I was thinking in our current challenges with this virus pandemic, I mean, if you could have like, you know, say the doctors in ER that are seeing individual patients, if they could, you know, get that data and it's quickly accessible by the CDC and other, I mean, I know they're doing it some with the testing, but that's, you know, wonky and focused on different, you know, different companies doing different types of testing, which has been, you know, delaying, you know, the results. But I was just thinking in terms of healthcare, with the doctors and ERs being at the, in our case, in the military, the fleet level, you know, then the CDC is like the big government agent, you know, then the CDC is like the big government agency that, you know, is trying to make decisions. You know, I think the quicker that they can integrate things like that would be good. And I guess right now, are they really trying to do things on a county by county basis? I don't know if you're at VCU or if you've been involved in any of that, how the data rolls up to.
I'm a student. I'm not at those meetings. I mean, I've basically just been following the Virginia Department of Health website to kind of see how they're kind of popping the cases.
Yeah.
One thing I did notice, you know, with a lot of the predictive models that are out there, you know, they have a lot of assumptions. And when you look into the assumptions, you realize that the reason why they're assuming these things is because they don't have that data. And that goes back to, you know, the demographics, because I mean, when you just see a case, you know, it's like, you know, where was that person at? Was that a bus station, nursing home? That drives your policies, what you're going to do so much differently, right? I mean, that was my big thing, just the lack of granularity to that data.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine from your seat, you know, being in data analytics, it's got to be tough because everybody wants information. But like from day to day, and I think what you just described explains to me a lot, like why I saw something in the UK. They're like, oh, 600,000 people could die of this, you know, and then they're like 3 days later, it's like, well, it looks like it might be 20,000. You know, it's like that's like 30 times, you know, right. Difference. But yeah. like you were saying, as they get some more accuracy on demographics and, you know, the rate of spread and the way that curve looks, you know, it shifts wildly, you know, which I think is frustrating, you know, frustrating from a consumer's perspective.
Population density, the actual amount of people in there, you know, I mean, we're definitely learning a lot as far as, you know, as they lessons learned. It's definitely hard to really understand. I mean, it's definitely a problem, but it's hard to go back and forth from, like you said, you know, 6 million to like 6,000.
Yeah, you know, almost everything I've seen in statistics, the more data points you have, the more refined, you know, solution you get for whatever, you know, whatever you're trying to determine. If this COVID-19, all along, I've kind of thought that, you know, everybody was saying, oh, 4%, 5% death rate, you know, they're kind of float numbers out there. In my mind, on the ground floor, you know, just practicing seeing patients, I think that probably there's a vast herd. Let's just take the data from China on the COVID-19. I don't think they have numbers on a fraction of the people that actually had the infection.
Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, it's probably they're not. In a country like the United States, it's taken us what, almost a month to ramp up to we're doing any kind of testing. In the county that I'm in right now, they were like just the other day, they're like, okay, we have 14 cases in our county. Well, quite frankly, I've been seeing strange illnesses for 2-3 weeks already. You know, that were kind of like strange respiratory illnesses that were non-flu, non-A, non-B, you know, these types of things. And so what's interesting to me is that I think it's just a fact that we haven't actually tested enough people. And actually more, you know, if you look at a death rate of 4%, that's based on the ones they tested. But the reality is, I'm not trying to make this sound like it's not serious. I mean, we're all following the guidelines and doing the best we can. We don't want anybody to get sick and die from this. But the reality is, for the vast herd of people out there, I'd be willing to bet we're not counting a fraction of the people, which again throws off your data. Yeah. I mean, if you had 50,000 people in China that didn't even get tested but went home or stayed home and drink, you know, had chicken soup and took some Tylenol or whatever, you know, those people didn't ever report, they didn't ever, you know, even complain about it. And so how do you you make decisions based on this bigger number that's on a smaller, you know, it's like a subset of only the sickest of the sick. Yeah. Or the ones that were lucky enough to actually become a data point. Yeah. I think that's what we're going to see over time. And I think before this, you had sent us an article, and one of them was on this idea of, looking at telltale antibodies to the COVID-19 and populations sort of after the fact. Because I have a feeling that we're going to find out if they actually come up with an antibody that can say whether you had the infection or not, whether you even knew you were sick, I'd be willing to bet there's a lot of people walking around with that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I mean, my thought process with that one is like, say, you know, again, this is my personal opinion, thought. I don't know how well this is backed by science, but if you do have the folks in like Washington State, you know, California, where they were hit earlier, you can probably get the antibodies there and the plasma and get those to places like New York that are just now going through these massive, you know, growth rates, and hopefully, you know, take some of that demand off the system.
Yeah, so you're talking about actually taking a plasma from one patient that is known to make antibodies or, you know, to that, and actually using that as a therapy, transfusing it to other people.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, yeah, and it's funny, not even going into analytics area of your expertise, Jerome, you know, like the doc was alluding to, you know, you don't even know. I mean, we don't even know what the, you know, denominators and numerators are of this equation, right? So it's like when you see, I know I almost like snicker at some of the recoveries. You know, it shows like how many cases. I mean, they try to cookie cutter it, but you just look at the numbers. It's like how many cases, how many deaths, and how many have recovered. Yeah, you know, and depending on what day you look at in the snapshot in time, you're like, wow. There's like twice as many deaths as people have recovered. But like the doc was alluding to, it's like we don't even know. I mean, that those are only recoveries out of the people that were tested and went into the database. Yeah. You know, so I mean, it can be, you know, 30 times smaller in terms of death rates and hospitalization rates. So, you know, I guess it's better to be overprepared and get ventilators and respirators, you know, set up. But I think we're in the era of, we have so much information in the need for the feeding frenzy of information just makes everything spool up, you know, 10 times faster.
Yeah, I was very impressed with Mayor Cuomo's brief from New York. I thought he did a great presentation with the numbers and really like kind of breaking down what they were seeing and the problems. Obviously, they're high population density. I mean, obviously they're, you know, the perfect storm for that. But a lot of good information, lessons learned.
Yeah, so you also sent over the article about alluding to the fact that I think there was like AI in some cases, you know, was predictive of this going to happen. Or...
So there's a really a cool company called Blue Dot. I don't know if you guys have heard of them. They basically built this like a web scraping platform is going out and pulling in all this data, all these articles about like certain cases across the country. And they're basically looking for patterns. And they're also looking at, transportation paths and basically, you know, taking those highly trafficked areas, looking at those case counts and saying, oh, you know, we see something happening here, you know, kind of a thing. And I think they were the only ones that were doing that. And the guy that built that, he's a doctor from Canada, I believe. And he actually, I think, they flew out to California to help them kind of identify where they see where their spreads may be the most growth at, based on, again, population density, transportation networks, that kind of thing.
Well, yeah, it reminds me of, you know, you can almost fill in the blank. I mean, you know, in economic terms, I remember, you know, learning about, you know, widgets as just like an example of like, hey, a company, it doesn't matter what company it is, or what they produce, you know, here's generally speaking how profit and loss works. And so I think right now we're seeing kind of this dawn, like with AI, whether it be COVID-19, or I know in the military, you know, the intel analysts are using similar technology where they can rule in or rule out where high value targets may be located on the planet, because it's like, okay, if you do these certain things, you know, this is going to be kind of your pattern of life, or these are, you know, you're going to have some combination of IT connectivity and some like human couriers, you know, getting you information. And this is how you would travel that information. So I think it's kind of interesting where you can almost fill in the blank, whether it be health or, you know, military intelligence, that companies like Blue Dot are going to, you know, can really probably work with anything. If you have, like, you know, Dr. Curtis was saying, you know, you have more data points and you can fill in the equations on what you're trying to find out, right?
Yeah, you know, it's all about, you know, patterns and having someone that understands, you know, what that pattern means, right? Or you know, being able to put context around it. You know, he was able to put context around certain types of cases popping up, see a pattern, and, you know, be able to, and then put that together with the temptation network. So, okay, hey, you know, this is coming together. This is going to be a problem, and this is where we see the problems at. So he was able to kind of predict what cities would have the most, problems with the virus spreading.
Let's unpack that a little bit, because I think for listeners, I mean, I know I read the article that you'd sent over on that about Cameron Kahn. I guess he's the founder or the Blue Dot or somehow the developer. What is interesting about that is what we're talking about is Blue Dot is a technology where they're scanning. I guess they're picking out specific medical syndromes. Let's say like COVID-19, a certain pattern of symptoms. They're starting with those, and then they make some basic assumptions about maybe how it spread from person to person. Then they start scouring the internet for data, demographics about transportation, even with meaning things like airline flights, you know, which directions they would fly at what times. So if there was an outbreak in a certain region, they're starting to use these high-powered computers and specific algorithms to sort of predict what might happen. Again, not perfect, because you know it depends on the data that you're putting into it. But I find that stuff fascinating. I guess I'm a data geek or something. But I feel like that's where we need to be going. Some people are very scared of AI and this whole, you know, I think that physicians in the future, we're going to have to learn how to manipulate this data and use these powerful computers, because there's so much information and patterns that sometimes I think, you know, my kids and my wife, they're all artists. And I've noticed that one of the patterns of painting they did recently was this sort of coarse pixelation. In other words, it's like a dot, you know, lots of colored dots. And if you just looked at it really granular, it doesn't look like anything. Mm-hmm. But when you zoom out from it, it's this portrait, you know, and it's amazing to me as a practitioner. Like, the best I can do is I feel like I'm sitting there looking at this pixelation. You know, it's like, I can't make heads or tails of what's going on here in front of me. I can maybe see a little bit of a pattern, or this guy's overweight, he's got these issues, maybe he's got a little family history. But it's like such a rudimentary amount of information, whereas they're trying to take large pools of data, and they're not just asking like medical history about these people. They're looking at how they move, I think that article they were also talking about that they use their phone signatures or some kind of, you know, GPS data from their phones. I mean, that's pretty Big Brother stuff.
Well, a lot of cell phone companies actually sell that information, as far as they de-identify it. It gives you an idea of the actual numbers there.
Sorry, strip your ID out of it, but they know where those little cell phones are moving around, the dots on the pegboard, if you will.
Yes.
I think that stuff's fascinating myself. And so are you involved? You know, you mentioned forecast simulation. That's something you're into. Is that what? How does that fit in with? I mean, what kind of things are you working on in this field?
I still kind of straddle both the supply chain side and the healthcare side. So for me, it just kind of depends on the data set and then what kind of insight I'm trying to achieve. One of my favorite algorithms is XGBoost. It's a really good machine learning algorithm, basically where you identify what your target variable is, and you take a bunch of other variables and kind of figure out like which one's actually driving your target variable the most.
Which change it the most. Yes. So give an example of that. Like, what would be a good example?
For example, actually, I sat through a brief today. where the nurses are using it for a basically to understand fragility as a person gets older, kind of understand like what in their brain changes as far as making them more fragile. They basically had a bunch of image data that kind of had different measurements of different parts of the brain over time. And so what they did was they did a little bit of feature engineering and made that into changes over time. And then based on changes over time, and then the target variable was the frailty, they're able to see what parts of the brain actually drove that frailty the most.
Okay, so they're looking at actual imagery, maybe functional PET scanning or MRIs, and they're looking at the delta change over time, and they're able to predict either levels of disease or predict maybe the progression of a disease. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
That's fascinating. Back when I was a medical student, I think it was a second year medical student in San Antonio. I worked with a guy named Donald Royal. He was a medical doctor that did a tremendous amount of work with prediction of dementia. And so what he would do is he had various screening tools like Clax drawings and mini mental state exams and all these paper, pen and paper sort of ways to screen people. And I think, I don't know, I worked with him all summer. I think I interviewed every elderly person in San Antonio one summer. And what's fascinating is looking, and what he was searching for in his own way without powerful computers, he was looking at a way, what little features maybe will a person display, what symptom would explain certain parts of the brain functioning or not functioning properly, and which ones would predict whether a person becomes demented or not. And so we were looking preferentially at people who really weren't overtly demented, but had subtle symptoms. And so we would do things, I don't know if you're like a Clox drawing where you draw, I'm sure you're familiar with this, but basically you would ask the patient, draw a picture of a clock, put the time at 1:30 and draw all the numbers in hands. And then there was a scoring system for that. And that's what I would do. I would go and ask all these questions to patients. And, you know, you ask them to draw the clock. And it was amazing how normal people could be, but they would have very severe signs of dementia as far as their spatial planning and things like that. Anyway, fast forward 20 years, and now we're starting to look at ways to take data points and put them into this machine that can crunch them, calculate them, and correlate them, and come out with some sort of probabilities of, you know, these types of conditions. And I just find all that fascinating.
Yeah, and the cool thing too is you actually have, you know, like a gene marker in there as well. So you can identify gene markers that may be driving some of these conditions also.
Yeah, so then you can now cross-reference that type of information with like basic clinical information can be inputted into a data set, and then you could actually take work and cross-reference that. I think, who the heck comes up with these algorithms? I mean, how do they, is it like a computer engineer that comes up with that? Who comes up with that stuff?
I mean, a lot of these algorithms have actually been around for a long time. It's just the compute, you're now able to do it at a much larger scale. Now, XGBoost is a newer one, but a lot of the things that people use today, Random Forest and some of these other algorithms, they've been around for a long time.
Yeah. And we were skirting around the idea of AI. Are you familiar with Watson, the IBM computer?
I am.
Are you familiar with that, Jerome? So I found out recently, and I don't know, I think for a lot of, you know, I've had people ask me, hey, should I go into medicine? I'm thinking about radiology and stuff. And what was interesting to me is that they actually have computers so powerful now that you can actually, IBM has a software that you can rent or per month, and it will actually read images and x-rays and MRIs. It actually, the computer, we're talking about a computer, actually took the radiology boards and scored better than, you know, 99% of the physicians combined on the earth. And they actually have an oncology version of the same computer that allows a doctor to punch in data, like say a patient has breast cancer, 42-year-old female, and also had tamoxifen therapy 5 years ago and is currently on this medicine. What is the best next step for this this patient? Well, This computer will read every journal and correlates all the information on a daily basis for every cancer journal in the face of the planet. Mm-hmm. And you can literally go through and get like sort of what does the algorithm tell me is the best solution right now at this point in time. And some people, I've talked to some docs that that scares them, that there's computers that can read an image better than they can. But the thing is, I look at this and think we should be using this data. Like, I get the big picture that I'm just a family doctor, but if you gave me information that said, you know, if Jerome came to me and said, hey, your patient, I've came up with this new program, and it shows that if your patient does genetic testing, I can give you a pretty good certainty whether their medications are going to cause them problems or not. I would love that to just be an automated set thing that's built into my pharmacy software, so that, you know, the same way as it checks side effect profiles or interactions with drugs, I can literally write a prescription that goes, hey, warning doctor, this patient has a specific, you know, genomic allele that makes them prone to bleeding if you give them that medicine. Whoa, okay, I don't want to do that.
Now there is, I would love there is that. One thing about AI that I, you know, that is a big concern. It's all about the training data. And so if that algorithm sees something it hasn't seen before, it's not going to make that jump that a doctor would make. So that's one issue where you have like all these different types of data sets. And it's also the reason why you saw a lot of issues with the self-driving cars having some problems, you know, as far as like seeing something you haven't seen before and not being able to actually think. I think you got to keep that doctor loop, you know, kind of thing, almost like airline pilots too. You know, they can get too reliant on the technology, right? You gotta make sure you keep that balance going.
So you're saying if you put bad data in, or if there's something novel that it's never seen before, it's not going to necessarily know what that is, and can definitely miss the boat and misdiagnose the thing. Whereas a physician might recognize, or you know, a human being might recognize the subtlety that is novel.
Yes.
That's something completely different.
I think with this discussion, gentlemen, my brain keeps jumping to the dark side a little bit, and I was thinking about some of the ethical concerns that inevitably come up with this, right? When we talk about using data for healthcare, and especially AI, because you think about especially places like China or other places that have more heavily socialized medicine. I mean, you work with the state a little bit, Jerome, but I mean, is there a fear that because you have all this, you know, data showing you have a 75-year-old person that has these markers, and it's like, if you get to where you're, will it essentially be a dictate on rationing healthcare? You're like, hey, it's not worth investing in this person because it's not going to have a good outcome. Is that some ethical discussion?
It definitely opens up a lot of ethics questions. And also, you know, making sure that people that are making the decisions, you know, understand what's actually happening. The pace of the technology is so fast. You got to make sure decision makers, you know, understand what it means, and that ethics piece is addressed and out there. It almost seems like the legal system may have to adjust a little bit and have some of these AI folks in there to kind of help with some of these issues.
Yeah, I mean, you think about, I understand it from the battlefield perspective, right? You're triaging people and, you know, you're getting shot at and, you know, battlefield medic type decisions. But, you know, you hear the horror stories about places like Italy where because they're, you know, that case they're just tapped, but they're also, I think, more of a socialized medicine standard where they're like, okay, we're essentially not going to treat anybody over 80, at least the way I understood it. Regardless, I mean, you could have an 80-year-old person that runs marathons and you're treating them with a respiratory disease like somebody who's a standard Italian smoker that doesn't have but, you know, 50% lung capacity anyway. So I think that's where, whether it be AI or socialized medicine, you know, as a human, you're like, oh, I don't want somebody to treat me as a statistic. Yeah. And so I guess that's the slippery slope when you talk about, you know, AI.
Yeah. What is society willing to accept?
You know, as we were talking about this, my mind is flying over about 20 years of medical career, and I'm thinking of situations where data, a specific bit of data was available at specific times, but it wasn't all encompassing. Let me give you one example. Like, I was a young ER doctor just out of residency, and I was working in a trauma center, And there was a guy that came in. I think he had flipped off a motorcycle and, I don't know, you know, hit something hard enough that his heart stopped, blunt force trauma. And so when the paramedics brought him in, they're doing CPR on the guy. And I go ahead and my team takes over and we're doing CPR. We're coding the guy, basically trying to get his heart to start again. And I called the trauma surgeon, you know, and I said, okay, get down here, man. I got this guy, you know, his heart stopped and he's busted up and I'm going to need you on board. And so the guy comes down and he looks and he goes, what happened? I said, blunt force trauma, flipped off a motorcycle, you know. And he goes, has he had a pulse since they left the scene? And I said, no, but we've been doing CPR. And he says, okay, you know, and he kind of gave me this look, and like, this sounds kind of crass, but he's like, you know, Curtis, please give me something I can work with here. And he goes, I'm not, he goes, call it. And I said, you haven't even done anything. You haven't even evaluated the patient yet. And he goes, and he pulled out, and he didn't do it at the time. He showed me later, but he says, call it. The guy's not going to make it. And I was really mad at the time. And I remember, you know, I was a younger doctor. This was a seasoned trauma surgeon. And I remember thinking, well, hell, man, you didn't even try. You know, you didn't even work on this guy. He's fairly young, you know. Anyway, so later I see him in the doctor's lounge, and I kind of confronted the guy a little bit. I said, hey, man, you know, I called you down there, and you just sort of dished me and left this guy, called it, and you didn't even hardly evaluate the guy. And actually what he told me, he says, go look it up. And he pulls out a trauma manual, and he shows me the, you know, the guidelines. He goes, blunt force trauma. He goes, well, asystole, which means your heart isn't moving. And it hasn't. There's no electrical rhythm. Blunt force trauma, asystole, has less than a 0.1% chance of recovery. And I was like, it was a stat. It was data that's out there. I just didn't know that data. And here I am asking a guy to do something and spend resources and you know, maybe we're going to pump this guy with blood and we're going to do all this stuff. And he was right. Although I can understand how we don't want to be a number, and I could give you a dozen crazy stories that would like spin your head of like people that were dead that set up and talked to you and stuff that sounds ludicrous, but I would love to have that data that says, you know, this person has all these issues and this is their probability of success based on a fairly good set of data. And I know that's we're getting further and further down the road where that's going to be more likely. But I would love more data sets. Ultimately, I'd love to be the person that makes the decision. And we all have that sort of gut instinct of like, I'm going to go for it with this guy. And, you know, Chris, I was thinking back to, you remember our interview with Bill Lathrop? You know, we called him the modern day Lazarus, a guy that had no pulse for 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And he had all these miraculous things and he had this afterlife experience. This is, by the way, Jerome, this is one of the guys that came, interviewed before you, interesting guy. But he was a guy that was a statistical improbability, but everyone involved, you know, did it. So I know that there's gotta be this balance, but I don't think that having more information is a bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It reminds me of, Jerome mentioned airline pilots and, you know, there's a lot of AI essentially built into automatic flight control systems. You know, some of our older aircraft in the military don't have it, but obviously commercial aircraft and a lot of our newer aircraft in the military will essentially keep you from doing things even that you're trying to do. I mean, I've talked to pilots where, you know, they're trying to do A plus B equals C, and the controls like lock and won't let them do it because it's like, in some cases it's thinking ahead of you because you focus on two factors and there's three factors involved. Right. And you know, a lot of the emergency procedures that they perform, they talk about being written in blood. It's like, if the, you know, this engine goes out and these are the factors, this is what you do. So, I mean, you know, in medicine, you know, in some cases there might be more variables even than flying the same aircraft in similar conditions. But, you know, I think that's what Dr. Curtis is talking about. It's like, you know, if you have the benefit of all this collation of information that you can, you know, immediately draw upon, it'd be helpful. So I guess, Jerome, what I know you've done some work with the state and you've done some work in, you know, in the private sector, being a consultant, but I guess what's the, you know, in our lifetimes, you know, we're all relatively close to the same age. I mean, what's kind of a good end state to, I guess, the intersection of data and health, you know, in the industries that you've looked at? What's kind of a foreseeable future that's good for all of us?
I mean, as far as, I guess the data-driven type decision-making kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know you've worked on specific niche areas, but even in the niche areas you work, like, what's an example of something you've worked on? Like, hey, if we could get there, you know, here's what we could do with data.
Okay, so I will give you my my research area. So basically, for my project, I'm looking at Parkinson's disease patients, and we know that for Parkinson's, we know that exercise improves cognitive function. And so there's been a lot of research, actually, I want to say the School of Medicine, as far as actually what genes, you know, can tell you whether or not you are a, basically, are you a, what type of exercise you respond to. If you don't respond to cardio, you know, we can say that you may be able to respond to like a medium intensity interval training. So if you're not a responder to cardio and biking, we know that if we do more of like a maybe like a moderate CrossFit, more interval type training, we can simulate that same kind of activity. And so basically, what I want to do is look at Parkinson's disease patients and their genomics to figure out what exercises would be the best to optimize what exercises and drugs will work to best optimize that cognitive function.
That's cool. So you almost would give it like, you know, I know Dr. Curtis and I have talked a lot about, you know, even him being a traditional MD, wanting to prescribe, you know, diet and exercise for a lot of these conditions, you know, especially like metabolic conditions and also, you know, neurological conditions like Parkinson's disease respond to it. So that'd be kind of cool to, you know, give the doctor the background to say, hey, you know, part of your prescription for this person is not only going to be drugs, you know, which people are used to getting, you know, 10 prescriptions. And, you know, like Dr. Curtis has talked about, there's pretty much 100, if you have more than two or three medications, there's 100% chance that some of the side effects are going to intersect and not be good for you, you know? So to have a prescription for a certain type of exercise in addition to drug therapy, you know, would be really cool to have that at your fingertips. You know?
Wait. So let me get this right. So you're saying that they have you from a genomic profile, gene profile, you can determine that a specific type of exercise would benefit a specific, like say one person with Parkinson's, the theory is that you can tell them exactly which kind of exercise will benefit them the
yes.
most. Is that right?
So basically I've been looking to figure out like how well they respond to whether, you know, whether it be cardio or strength training. I want to say they call it, responders and non-responders, is whether they respond best to cardio and biking, or whether they respond better to a medium interval type training, whether it be some kind of low, medium intensity, medium
resistance
intensity interval training. So based on,
and what would be your end, like your end point? Like, what are you measuring? What's the outcome you're looking for?
Cognitive function. So right now they use a similar test to what you said, a clock drawing. I actually like to use some kind of gaming type system, whether it be Scrabble,
right.
Flashcard, something more. I can Tetris, something I can get a little bit of that spatial stuff as well as some of the words and
right,
skills.
Right.
Just kind of like have them play a game over time and see how well their cognitive function improves with those game scores.
Interesting. That is, God, you know, everybody we've ever had on the show, it's interesting to me. I always learn something, and this is you're giving me a little sneak peek into, you know, I've been out of medical school 20 years, and though I try to read and stay up, you know, I'm a primary care doctor, so I don't get into the weeds sometimes with some of these other things. This is exciting to me, hearing what's on the horizon. I would love for something to pop on my EMR screen one day that says, by the way, your patient has this. And you're not just supposed to go tell them, yeah, you should walk 45 minutes three times a week or four times a week. This is specifically what you should do based on your health issues. I love that.
And I want to say, I think it's a college course of medicine. They've gone through and looked at Olympic athletes and other athletes to kind of tell you, based on their gene markers, you know, lung capacities and different types of endurance testing. It's pretty impressive data out there.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of, I think I read a book called The Sports Gene. that was really interesting. It talked about how the same type of thing. I mean, you can learn a lot from looking at the highest end performers. And there were some people that, you know, just because of their genomics, they said, well, you know, and Olympic athletes are getting this done more than the average person. But they looked at their muscle fibers. They looked at, you know, blood markers, genetics, and they said, hey, you should only work out like two or three times a week, and you can like really wreck your body and then just give more recovery time. And there were some people that it's like, okay, to get the max out of your, you know, genomics and your muscle fibers, you know, you need to work out 5 days a week and your body will adapt. And so it's kind of cool just to think that, I mean, that's for high end athletes, but you know, in terms of disease and just the regular Joe, there is a kind of a recipe out there.
That's exactly where it's coming from.
Yeah.
You know, it's this is really, leave it to me to get into the weeds here, but my wife does work with Ayurvedic medicine, which is sort of ancient, you know, Sanskrit medicine. It's been around for thousands of years. And what's interesting is, you know, I've just kind of done some light reading and the things that her text and things that she studied. And what's fascinating is that where we are with modern medicine, if you look at nutrition and lifestyle, a lot of the guidelines, a lot of the things that were not really guidelines, a lot of the things that were starting to be formulated are very, very specific, tailored dietary things, you know, for specific, like a specific individual requires specific dietary things. Like, and in Ayurvedic medicine, they call it dosha types. Well, what's interesting is like certain dosha types, like I'm not an expert in this, so I'm, you know, this is all secondhand here. But what's interesting is the dosha types were very specific with nutrition. So things like my wife will tell me, hey, you shouldn't have coconut milk. I'm like, well, why is that? Well, that's not your dosha type. And they actually have certain foods that are like, this is good for you. This is, you know, and there's characteristics of what makes a specific dosha. What I would be really interested over time, and I think we're a ways off from that right now, is to compare what you're talking about with how specific we're getting with specific types of exercise, how specific drugs might interact with a certain person. I think it could get down to the point where these dosha types might be proven to be partially true based on our own genetic code. I mean, because these are things that they've learned over thousands of years of basically observational medicine. Like, oh, you know, this patient has, you know, certain problems, and every time he eats this certain food, he gets this problem, and he's like this other person, if you follow what I'm saying. So they start to get these formulas of, you know, over thousands of years of observing people. Well, essentially, what are they watching? They're carefully watching our genetic expression.
Yeah.
And I think that's fascinating that maybe, you know, all of this is sort of coming full circle that we, and I've noticed in my own career that certain nutritional recommendations are starting to go back to more, you know, kind of paleo primal type things that we all know that human beings shouldn't be eating crap and processed sugar and everything else. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating that we might be starting to get hard genetic science that explains why people traditionally have been known to have certain dosha types, certain food sensitivities. I do better on this diet, or I do better with this specific type of exercise. I don't know if that makes sense to you guys, but to me, this has been a real eye opener to hear what's actually out there and what like kind of stuff you're working on. It's pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, the last thing, I know you sent some stuff over, Jerome. I know, I didn't know if you wanted to talk about it, but I know it's kind of related to current events, but I didn't know if there's any data that you had looked at, or if there's data analytics behind, you know, like using certain like natural compounds to fight, you know, respiratory viruses. I know there was some stuff about, you know, green coffee bean extract. Yeah. And so was that interesting just based on what's going on, or is there any analytics?
I started reading a lot of research about some of the viral infections, and then I saw a lot of research coming out of the UK and also Asia, Japan specifically, about how caffeine can actually be used, you know, to inhibit viral infections. And then I, you know, did some more research. I actually found a researcher out in Italy who done a lot of work, a lot of, I would say, kind of like, I guess, cultivating all the research to date, and kind of did a nice little paper about it. And basically what it comes down to is we definitely know that caffeine slows down viral infections, but we don't know how. And there hasn't been a lot of research into, I guess, actual live patients. It's all been in the lab. So, you know, just with the amount and volume of, I would say, infection and cases, I'm just thinking, hey, you know, this is not a good time to kind of see, hey, can coffee help? So.
Yeah, well, and I was going to say, you know, and Dr. Curtis can weigh in on this, but I know, you know, being a patient and having various illnesses over my lifetime, it's like, you know, the assumption was, hey, if you have a bacterial infection, we can treat it with antibiotics. But most things that are, you know, are presenting like a viral infection, you know, don't necessarily respond that well to antibiotics. Your own body has to figure it out, develop the antibodies and mm-hmm. kill it. So I thought it was interesting. Well, and like what you're talking about, you know, and they're talking about these anti-malaria drugs that, you know, some cocktail, but, you know, so essentially boosting your own body's ability, you know, to deal with the disease as quick as possible, because I guess that's what they're saying too. It's like, if you're exposed to a lot of the virus, you know, quickly and your body can't get ahead of it, then it has this like mass, you know, what they call, I guess, a cytokine storm where your own body's, so it's like your own body's immune system begins attacking itself. And that's where you see a lot of the lung tissue damage. It's, but I thought it was interesting. They said some cocktail of, a Z-Pak, you know, common antibiotic and this anti-malarial drug. So I don't know if the doc wants to weigh in on, you know, from what my rudimentary understanding, it's like antibiotics don't work on viruses, but how would that cocktail somehow work on that, doc?
So I've kind of thought about this in a couple different ways. First, let's take the Z-Pak to start with. First off, being antibacterial, people who, let's say you catch a virus and the virus invades your tissues, you create an immune response, that creates a weakened state. In other words, membranes, like let's say the lining of inside of your lung, your alveoli in your lungs, that lining gets irritated and inflamed. Well, it becomes a place that's raw and it's a barrier that's been broken. Well, there's always bacteria in and around us. Most of the time the bacteria are our friends, but sometimes that bacteria is harmful and you never know where those are. We're not sterile creatures for the most part. What ends up happening is that bacteria gets in there and then you get this mixture of a viral thing going on and then this bacteria jumps into the party and it's like the dude that comes in, you know, to the big college party and he tears the stuff off the walls and everything. Stuff kind of goes crazy at that point. Well, the thing about that is, to my mind, adding a Z-Pak when somebody's severely ill might just simply be just that. It might be that we're retarding the progression of a bacteria, and that might benefit that person. Now, second possibility is and Jerome might have comments about this as well. There's a ton, we're finding out that there's a lot of medicines that you would never dream that, like, oh, I'll give you this medicine, it's going to kill a bacteria, that's the good thing about it. But there could be something completely backwards or different that you never understood that drug is doing. And that could be something in how it modulates immune function. It might be something it's doing at the level of the mitochondria, which is, you know, your energy powerhouses. It might be something that's causing that mitochondria to behave differently. There's so many things like that. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you mentioned exactly what this hydroxyquinone medicine, I'm mispronouncing it, that medicine gets used for myelodysplastic syndromes. It gets used for other sort of inflammatory disorders like autoimmune disorders and things like that. Yeah. What that does is it in some way, it's blocking certain activation of our immune system. So that's
so that damage that people. I was talking about, your immune system goes nuts and it
exactly.
starts like, you know,
it's
you
like
know,
a, it's like, you know, your body gets an infection and goes, you know, we need to send in, I'll use a military one. How's this? So we need to send in the Navy SEALs, you know, to fix this, right? Solve this problem, right? Or I guess you send the Marines, not the Navy SEALs. Yeah. So we send the Marines but really the body instead decides to push the nuclear option, drop the bomb.
That's
what happens. It's like it's a massive overreaction and there's certain reasons it happens. I think that's why this other drug, that they're talking about in combination with this Zithromax is probably it's modulating some of that severe inflammatory reaction that might otherwise kill the, you know, it's like the cure kills the person because it's too, you know, strong of a reaction. I think there's some truth in some of that I said, and it's like the two people that killed themselves with drinking, you know, aquarium treatment or something. Cleaner, yeah. I mean, these are people that don't understand that they weren't even sick to begin with. This is a treatment that they're giving to sick people. Yeah. And that are in the, you know, like a, you know, one of the leading reasons people die in this country is sepsis. And what is sepsis? It's an infection of the bloodstream that causes a massive and utter, you know, massive response from the immune system that leads to multi-system organ failure. That's what that is. So it's kind of like, I'm sure that if you really looked at the cause of death on a lot of these people with COVID-19, it's probably some version of sepsis.
I definitely read that. I mean, it's kind of crazy because they were saying that that's the challenge of some of these emergency room workers is because they're dealing, and like what you're trying to prevent in your clinic, like you talked about, Doc, is, you know, you don't want super sick people that have a high fever, you know, with tons of high concentrations of virus and all their fluids, you know, coming into contact with you or people in the clinic. Because it basically said that the data is showing that, like, you know, this is not some special virus, right? This is not a virus that your body can't deal with. But but the virus you're going to get, I mean, obviously we're trying to not go in public and touch a doorknob and touch our face. But the amount of virus that you're going to get exposed to by touching a doorknob and touching your face, even if you get sick, I mean, the data kind of looks like most healthy people, their immune system can deal with that. And you may not even get that sick. But the people that are like inhaling, you know, a giant high concentration of droplets from a sick person, you know, that's when they go from like a scratchy throat and fever, and the next day they're in the ER because their body, you know, is dealing with like a huge amount of the virus, you know, attacking their system versus like, you know, the standard way people get sick, I guess, you know, because like they were talking to some of the immunologists and virologists, and they were saying, you know, this is not some, you know, if you look at it compared to other, you know, flu or pneumonia viruses, it's not like this crazy thing that your body can't deal with. It's just like, you know, it has to do with the demographics like Jerome talked about and like how you ingest the virus, right? I mean, I guess it's like part of it. It's kind of a crazy situation we're dealing with.
Absolutely. Hey, Jerome, what do you think about if you have any thoughts on this, there's a lot of talk about what the statistics look like for this flattening of the curve. Mm. What do you think? I mean, I've looked at it and I think there's so many I'll give my two cents. I think there's so much missing data points that a lot of this stuff is hard to analyze.
So did Chris show you the assumptions I sent him? I sent him the assumptions for the model, and you look at the assumptions, it's like you'll laugh a little bit. Because I mean, basically what they say is they're missing population density. They're missing the actual population for the areas. They don't have the hospital capacities. They're just going off of old data. There's just so many data gaps in how that model is built. But I know the reason why, because they don't have the EHR stuff. They don't have current census stuff. They don't have current hospital bed numbers. So I understand why. But you're right. There is so much data missing from those models.
Well, I think you explained a lot of what, you know, is boggling to me that I talked about when we first started, Jerome, was like, you know, the UK or even in New York City, you know, from day to day, because they don't have, you know, those things filled out. They're like, okay, well, the algorithm, as you change, you know, different data points, it's going to swing wildly, right? You know, because if it assumes like, you know, the curve is going to continue and, you know, it doesn't have capacity and it doesn't have population density and some of these things, because, you know, there were cities like Rome in Italy that, you know, have higher population density and you know, were more at risk. But because the way, you know, other factors involved, they didn't have the spike in, you know, illness like we did in New York City. So it's kind of, it kind of reminds me of like all politics are local, you know, some of these epidemics or, you know, some of the pandemics and epidemics that we have, you know, it's like, hey, you know, there's some certain things about people's patterns of life and, you know, demographics in the area that really can change. You know, it's not like it is a nationwide, worldwide problem, but it's very different. Yeah. It's very regional and county by county.
I think the best metric is basically number of deaths, how that's changing over time. That's going to give you the best indicator of what's happening in that area.
I agree with that too. I think the death rate is most key for sure. It's at least most reliable for how serious it is in a certain area. Hey, I know this is, and you feel free to call my BS on this as far as being anecdotal, but I got a quick story. Do you remember the swine flu? I think Obama was in office whenever that came out. And
I do because I think I had it. I think.
I know I had it, and I had it 6 months. We knew it was out there. So first off, as a medical community, we knew it existed. I came down with a case of the flu in the middle of the summer, and I thought, this is strange. I went ahead and did the viral swab that was a specific test for the swine flu, sent it off to the county, and they came back and says, yes, you had the swine flu. 6 months later, Obama was on TV telling us all how what a big problem it was. It was an epidemic. And the swine flu was going to hit your community, and they were talking about it. And I can't stop thinking about that with this, because I think I've seen in recent weeks, I've seen strange illnesses that are non-A, non-B flu that don't turn up positive for strep or any other things that we typically test for. The patients get better, but it was a strange illness. It was rather short. It was rather abrupt. And it affected the respiratory tree quite a bit. And in the back of my head, and I'm not saying that's what this is, but it just kind of strikes me that, you know, these things I think move faster than we realize. And I think it's kind of hopeful that in some sense, I think a lot more people have already been affected by this and are maybe okay. Not saying don't go out. You know, I am a doctor. I'm not telling you to go out. No, you don't have to worry about the containment or, you know, quarantine or anything. I'm not saying that. Do what everybody tells you to do. Take your precautions. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking it might be that this is something we're already in such a delayed response. Just like Jerome was saying, we don't have all the data. There's not even mechanisms in place to know what the variables are supposed to be. So I don't know if that's all BS, but I'm just telling you, that's a personal experience I had with a virus that was a big deal. That the government was talking about it 6 months after I had it, a documented case of it. I had viral pericarditis after it. I mean, I had to stop training for an Ironman because of it. And it was a big deal at the time. And I remember thinking, man, I feel like this almost killed me, you know? And then like 6 months later, well, this is a really big problem, you know? And I'm thinking, where in the hell? It's been here for a long time.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's funny. Like, I was in a military school, a resident school, for the better part of a year during that time. And I remember, you know, I was somebody that, you know, had shots for everything and been all over the world and really had never been sick that much. And then I think I was training for a marathon, so my immune system was probably already taking a hit, and I got really sick. And it's funny, with all the factors involved, the doctor was just like, hey, I'm not even going to test you for it. You know, you likely have it, you know, it's not worth doing it, but, you know, because I wouldn't treat you any differently, and I don't think you're going to have complications, you know, kind of like you said, doc, even with this, like, you know, go home, stay away from everybody, drink chicken soup, and, you know, take over the counter stuff for the other symptoms to make you feel better. And I mean, I was like, you know, after 3 days, I probably didn't have a fever. And after 4 or 5 days, I was, you know, back to, you know, light training. So I think that, hopefully, you know, we're just the victims of having too much information and overreacting because of the current environment. But, you know, hopefully it goes away and it's not a big problem.
Jerome, I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. And I think you're in a fascinating field. You know, it's funny. Sometimes I run into people that, you know, I'm down a career pathway that I'm going to stay on, you know, and I kind of, you know, people come to me, hey, I want to be a doctor. Should I be a doctor? And I'm like thinking, there's so many cool things that people are doing, and what you're researching and the kind of field that you're in is something that I think is going to be like the next level in not only in medicine, but in other fields, obviously, because it can be applied to other things. This whole idea of data crunching, looking for trends, looking for causal effect, I think it's fascinating. And I guess that's all I got tonight. Jerome, you got anything that we missed or something that's been burning on you about things we talked about?
I want to say there are some limitations to genomics. Are you familiar with epigenetics as far as the
Absolutely.
So genomics is one piece of it. We still also have to understand the proteins and also how the environment plays into some of these things. There's a really good study, I think they did in Canada. They looked at folks that had specific markers of a certain kind of diseases based on their genes, and all these folks were healthy. Right. we do have to understand the limitations, and you really got to get down to the causality and the environmental feedbacks as far as, take exercise, for example. If you look at exercise, actually changes your gene expression. I had no clue that it does that.
Right.
But it does. It changes how your genes express and transcript proteins. So it's. Yep. I mean, the body is an amazing, complex machine. So.
Yeah, I'm absolutely glad that you brought that up, because I talk to patients about epigenetics all the time, because in my community we have tons of diabetics. It's a largely Hispanic population in South Texas, and there's a huge propensity for diabetes. And I promote all the time, diabetes is reversible. I'm talking about type 2 diabetes. It's reversible. It's driven by carbohydrate sugar intake. If you don't eat those foods, then typically most of these people can achieve a, quote, cure of type 2 diabetes. I know that sounds controversial, but I've done it numerous times with patients, and it's exactly what you're saying. Yes, you might have the genes for something, but you have to do something to the body, feed it, poison it, or lack of physical activity. There's so many ways that the environment, it's kind of like one of those old books when I was a kid. We had these books that were choose your own adventure books. You can go to page 5 if you do X, or go to page 10 if you do Y, and you have these decisions as you read the story. That's a little bit how epigenetics, oversimplified, but that's kind of how epigenetics, as far as I understand it, that we really do, we might have some propensity for a problem, but it doesn't mean we have to be a victim of that if we, make the right lifestyle choices. And I hope that over time, genetics and the study of how that interplays with our environment, I'm hoping that lead, especially with data crunching and stuff, we're able to arrive at things that make real sense for people.
Yeah. I was going to say, I hope that informs people's behavior, because I think too often people, see that their family genetics that, are obesity or, certain type of diseases. But, what you're talking about, I think I was reading an article that talked about, like kind of Jerome was saying, that your, exercise impacts your, you can impact your genetics, And so like what you pass on to your children, it's like if you're more active and the lifestyle and diet and things that you do, and then you have children, that the way it's not all just genetic, you have some type of impact on those genetics if you what you pass on to your children. So I mean, the fact that kind of like we've talked about with Stoic philosophy, it's like you don't worry about things that are outside of your control, but if it's like within your control, then it gives you power. So I hope people, as more information comes out, both for doctors and patients, like, hey, I can make choices that can improve my outcomes and potentially my kids' outcomes. So that's a powerful lake of information, as we'd say. So. But Jerome, thanks for your time. Been going over an hour, so I'm sure the doc and I will brainstorm. We'll probably have you on again for some follow-on topics. I wish you luck in your research and what you're doing there in Virginia.
Okay, thanks for having me.
So, yeah, thanks
Jerome.
A lot.
Appreciate it.